The same religion that's capable of hideous acts of destruction can also be capable of moments of healing, of restoration, and of hope.
But educate a girl, and you educate her entire family.
There is a son within every person.
When that anger sets in, write it. Write the letters, but don't send them. You never want to leave concrete proof of insanity.
Imagine a more suitable speaker in our series than Alfred McCoy. He is currently the J.R.W. Smale Professor of History in the Center for Southeast Asian Studies at the University of Wisconsin in Madison. His education included an undergraduate degree from Columbia and a PhD in Southeast Asian history from Yale University. He first became a very influential, powerful presence within the political culture of this country with the publication of his book, The Politics of Heroin in Southeast Asia. It was a landmark book in many respects, published in 1972, and it explored what I think has been an abiding theme of his concerns, namely the deep politics of modern states, and particularly the United States, and especially the hidden connections between organizations that have questionable legitimacy, to say the least. And in The Politics of Heroin, he showed the linkages between organized crime and the Central Intelligence Agency. It was a sufficiently damaging expose that the CIA went to great pains to prevent the book from being published. But happily it was published. It's been frequently reissued and printed around the world. I believe it's been translated in 10 or more languages. And a new updated edition was published in 2003. His work also has been notable for probing more deeply than any other scholar into the nefarious subterranean politics of the Philippines, and showing again the very deep connections between different institutional entities within the country that have accounted for some of the brutality and oppression and criminal tactics of the Filipino government. There is a sentence in this exceptional book of Alfred McCoy that's just been recently published, A Question of Torture, that I recommend to everyone very highly. There is a sentence that I think captures the real essence of what this series is about. And let me read it. As the war on terror approached its fifth year, the question of torture moved from the margins of American consciousness to become in many ways the dominant political issue of the day. No longer a mere scandal, but a moral touchstone for divergent visions of the Republic. I can't imagine a better expression of the motivation that we had when we conceived of this series of events exploring the nature of torture. I want to say just one other thing that I think provides some sense of context for the talk we're about to hear. In the book, Alfred McCoy explains at the outset that his perspective on torture was very much affected by a very moving story about his mother's childhood, where she visited the torture chambers in Nuremberg and experienced some of the brutality of the early Nazi regime, and came to the conclusion, as he quotes her, "Torture is evil, pure and simple." Professor McCoy goes on to say in that part of the book, "I cannot, of course, start from her assumption of evil. I must, as an analyst of U.S. policy, begin with an open question, asking whether there might not be, in desperate times, some circumstances in which torture is effective, even justified. In short, this book is about policy, not a study of morality. It is written largely from a pragmatic perspective." And yet, somewhat mysteriously, I think, at the very end of the book, perhaps at the very last sentence, Professor McCoy reminds the reader of his mother's vision and concludes the book by saying that torture is evil, pure and simple. And so with that tension, let me invite Professor McCoy to the platform.
Richard, by the way, when it comes to questions, I think it might be best if you take them, because as I suspected, this proscenium stage with these lights that illuminate me to you blind you to me. So if somebody stick up their hands for a question and have a difficult time seeing it, maybe you could field them for me. Thank you for that generous introduction. How can I put it? I hope that the eloquence of my talk is but a fragment of the eloquence of the introduction. This afternoon, I will discuss a short history of psychological torture in a lecture with a prologue and four parts. Each of the four parts of this lecture describes a distinctive phase in the 50-year history of CIA psychological torture. First, discovery, then propagation, then perfection, and finally, legalization. First, a prologue. Entering the covert netherworld. Before starting this history of CIA torture, I would like to place this lecture in an academic context by explaining the method, the historiography, that makes such research possible. Working as an academic historian for the past 35 years, I have produced a half dozen books on seemingly diverse topics, from the global heroin traffic to the nature of Australian organized crime, and most recently to the character of CIA torture. Topics that are all part of a new interdisciplinary academic field that examines what I call, for want of better words, the covert netherworld. This netherworld is an invisible interstice between the formal and informal sectors of society where criminal syndicates and clandestine services collaborate in the exchange of illicit goods and extra-legal services. This is, I submit, an uncommon but not inconsequential field for those who wish to understand the complex global world that has emerged since the end of the Cold War. As an index of the scale of this covert netherworld, let's take its largest commodity, illicit drugs, which according to the United Nations generates 8% of world trade, larger than the trade in textiles, steel, or automobiles. In other words, the illicit drug traffic is now larger than the legal trade in textiles, one of three essentials, along with food and shelter, needed to sustain human life. As another indicator of significance, consider an obscure CIA interrogation doctrine called psychological torture that has recently emerged from the clandestine shadows, where it had been concealed for over half a century, to dominate U.S. domestic debate over the war on terror and discredit America's global leadership in the eyes of the world. Despite the growing significance of this force in shaping modern life, surprisingly few of my fellow historians from among the tens of thousands across the globe study this netherworld. Yet with even a modicum of skill, historical methods, I submit, can prove a powerful tool for scholars and journalists in probing this vast, still unexplored terrain, this covert netherworld. Through some coincidences at the cusp of two careers, journalism and history, I've developed a method that merges the historian's use of documents for long-term analysis with a journalist's reliance on first-person interviews for contemporary reportage. When used creatively, the past can serve as a powerful prism for illumination of an otherwise opaque present, highlighting an historical continuity otherwise concealed in a contemporary media glare. By using this method, we can discover the secret history of psychological torture that was hidden, rather like the purloined letter in Edgar Allan Poe's famed short story, right in plain sight on your desktops, not in the carved wooden letterbox of Poe's story, but in the search function on your desktop computers. Part one, discovery. In April 2004, Americans were stunned when CBS broadcast those now notorious photographs from Abu Ghraib prison showing hooded Iraqis stripped naked while U.S. soldiers stood by smiling. As this scandal grabbed headlines around the globe, Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld insisted the abuses were, quote, perpetrated by a small number of U.S. military, whom the conservative New York Times columnist William Safire soon branded as creeps. A line, indeed, that few in the press had reason to challenge. By contrast, when I looked at those photos, I did not see snapshots of simple brutality or a breakdown in military discipline. For example, that most iconic photo of a hooded Iraqi with fake electrical wires hanging from his extended arms shows not the sadism of a few creeps, but instead the two key trademarks of the CIA's psychological torture. The hood was for sensory disorientation. The arms were extended for self-inflicted pain. It was that simple, that obvious. By using the past to interrogate the present, I published a book titled A Question of Torture last year that tracks the trail of an extraordinary historical and institutional continuity through countless pages of leaked and declassified documents. And through this research, I found that from 1950 to 1962, the CIA led a secret research effort to crack the code of human consciousness, a veritable Manhattan Project of the mind with costs that reached at peak $1 billion a year. Many of you have heard about the most outlandish and least successful aspect of this research, the testing of LSD on unsuspecting subjects and the tragic death of a CIA employee, Dr. Frank Olson, who jumped or was pushed to his death from the 10th floor of a New York hotel after a dose of this drug. This agency drug testing, though sensational, and the focus of countless press stories and countless investigative reports, led nowhere. It was negative scientific findings. But obscure, CIA-funded behavioral experiments outsourced to the country's leading universities and done by our most brilliant behavioral scientists produced two key findings, all duly and dully reported in scientific journals, that contributed to the discovery of a distinctively American form of torture, psychological torture. Discovery number one, sensory disorientation. With funding from Canada's Defense Research Board, which was collaborating with the CIA in this larger mind control project, the famed Canadian psychologist Dr. Donald Hebb found that he could induce a state akin to psychosis in just 48 hours. What had the doctor done? Drugs? Hypnosis? Electroshock? No, none of the above. For 2 days, student volunteers at McGill University, where Dr. Hebb was chair of psychology, simply sat in a comfortable, air-conditioned cubicle deprived of sensory stimulus by goggles, gloves, and earmuffs. One of Hebb's subjects, the University of California, Berkeley English professor Peter Dale Scott, who was at McGill at that time as an undergraduate, has described these methods in his 1992 epic poem, Listening to the Candle. Let me read some stanzas because they're Scott's recollection of being a subject in this experiment. Nothing in those weeks added up, yet the very aimlessness preconditioning my mind of sensory deprivation as a paid volunteer in the McGill experiment for the U.S. Air Force, two CIA reps at the meeting. My ears sore from their earphones, amniotic hum, my eyes under two bulging halves of ping pong balls, arms covered to the tips with cardboard tubes. Those familiar hallucinations I was the first to report, as for example the string of cutout paper men emerging from a manhole in the side of a snow-white hill, distinctly two-dimensional. For 2 days they paid my mind to withdraw itself from every impulse but its own, to look only on itself, not seeing the objects as objects, the humor of the darkness emboldening me to search. Dr. Hebb himself found that after just 2 days of such isolation, quote, the subject's very identity began to disintegrate. If you compare drawings published in Scientific American in 1957 of Dr. Hebb's student volunteers and photos of today's Guantanamo detainees, the similarities in the goggles, gloves, and earmuffs is, for good reason, striking. Discovery number two, self-inflicted pain. During the 1950s as well, two eminent neurologists at Cornell University Medical Center, working under contract for the CIA in New York City, found that the KGB's most devastating torture technique involved not crude physical beatings, but simply forcing the victim to stand for days at a time, arms extended, while the legs swelled, the skin erupted in separating lesions, the kidney shut down, hallucinations began, all incredibly painful. Again, if you look at those hundreds of photos from Abu Ghraib, you will see repeated use of this method, now called euphemistically stress positions. Although the words in the CIA seem benign, if not banal, they read, when we look carefully at the CIA manuals that were later written, the broad outlines of that most persistent, most problematic, and most distinctively American form of torture, psychological torture. In 1963, after a decade of this research, the CIA codified these findings in the curiously named QBARC Counterintelligence Interrogation Manual. If genius is the discovery of the obvious, then the CIA's discovery of this psychological or no-touch torture was a counterintuitive breakthrough, the first real revolution in the cruel science of pains in centuries. Through more than 2,000 years of Western judicial torture, the same problem had persisted. The strong defied pain, while the weak blurted out whatever was necessary to stop it. By contrast, the CIA's psychological paradigm fused these two new methods, sensory disorientation and self-inflicted pain, whose combination in theory would cause victims to feel responsible for their own suffering and thus, in theory, capitulate more readily to their torturers. Refined through years of practice, sensory disorientation relies upon a mix of sensory overload, sensory deprivation via banal procedures, isolation, then intense interrogation, heat, then cold, light, then dark, noise, then silence, for a systematic attack on all human sensory stimuli. In its clandestine journey across continents and decades, this distinctively American form of psychological torture would prove resilient, elusive, adaptable, powerfully seductive, and devastatingly destructive, attributes that have allowed it to persist to the present and into the future. Let's review each of these attributes briefly. Elusive. Unlike its physical variant, psychological torture lacks clear signs of abuse and thus easily eludes detection, greatly complicating any investigation, prosecution, or attempt at prohibition. The second attribute, resilient. Psychological torture is shrouded in a scientific patina that appeals to policymakers and avoids the obvious physical brutality unpalatable to the American public. The third attribute, adaptable. In 40 years since its discovery, the agency's psychological paradigm has proved surprisingly adaptable, with each sustained application, as we will see, producing innovations. The fourth attribute, seductive. For both the perpetrators and the powerful who command them, torture has, I suspect, a darkly erotic appeal. Even when torture is initially intended for a few Soviet spies, as in the Cold War, or a few top Al-Qaeda commanders, as in the War on Terror, it soon spreads in two directions: rapid proliferation to the torture of the many, and an inexorable escalation in the scale of brutality. So seductive is torture's appeal to the powerful that they will always concoct rationale to preserve their prerogative of torture in defiance of all evidence of ineffectiveness in interrogation and all evidence of its enormously high political costs. Our fifth and final attribute, destructive. Although seemingly less brutal than physical methods, the CIA's no-touch torture actually leaves searing psychological scars. Victims often need long treatment to recover from a trauma that many experts with long experience of treatment of victims consider more crippling than mere physical pain. Part two, propagation. After codification in the 1963 Kubark Manual, the CIA spent the next 30 years propagating these torture techniques among anti-communist allies across Asia and Latin America. Now, I mentioned the desktop where this is all concealed. If you wish to read this manual for yourself, just Google the word Kubark, K-U-B-A-R-K, on your desktop computer. And if you do, focus on the footnotes with their elaborate citations of behavioral science experiments that contain both the intellectual genealogy and perverse genius of the CIA's psychological torture paradigm. Although these agency trained military interrogators across Latin America during the Cold War, our knowledge of the actual torture techniques comes from a single handbook for a Honduran training session, the CIA's Human Resources Exploitation Manual, 1983. Again, if you wish to read this manual for yourself, just go to your desktop and Google the phrase Human Resources Exploitation Manual. To establish control at the outset, the questioner should, the CIA instructor told his Honduran trainees back in 1983, quote, manipulate the subject's environment to create unpleasant or intolerable situations, to disrupt patterns of time, space, and sensory perception. To effect this psychological disruption, this 1983 CIA handbook specified techniques that seem strikingly similar to those outlined 20 years before in the Kubark Manual and those that would be used 20 years later at Abu Ghraib prison in Iraq. When the Cold War came to a close, Washington resumed its advocacy of human rights, ratifying the UN Convention Against Torture in 1994 that banned the infliction of severe psychological and physical pain. Now, on the surface, with the ratification of this UN Anti-Torture Convention, the United States seemed to have resolved the tension between its anti-torture principles and its torture practices. But, when President Clinton sent this UN Convention to Congress for ratification in 1994, he included language drafted 6 years before by the Reagan administration with four detailed paragraphs of diplomatic reservations, all focused on just one word in the 26 printed pages of this UN convention. That word was mental. Significantly, these intricately constructed diplomatic reservations redefined torture as interpreted by the United States to exclude sensory deprivation and self-inflicted pain, the very techniques that the CIA had refined at such great cost in decades past. This definition was reproduced verbatim in domestic legislation enacted to give legal force under U.S. law to this UN convention, first in Section 2340 of the U.S. Federal Code, and then in the War Crimes Act of 1996. Now, remember that number, Section 2340, for it is the key to unlocking the meaning of the controversial Military Commissions Law enacted by the U.S. Congress in September of last year. This is when we really need a blue book exam, This is what blue book exams are for. If this were one of my lecture classes at the University of Wisconsin, I would say, remember section 2340, and that's a signal saying it's going to be in the midterm. And so everybody would scribble it down and go off and read it. But you're just here, it's late in the afternoon, you're kind of drifting off. But just snap out of the reverie. Let me bring you back. 2340, 2340. Remember it, because it's very important in understanding the final and very important part of this lecture, the legalization part. In effect, by ratification of the UN Convention in this way, Washington kind of cut a deal with the UN. You know, you got a UN anti-torture convention, tell you what, split it down the middle. We'll ban that nasty physical stuff, but hey, forget about the psychological. We'll exempt that. By failing to repudiate the CIA's use of torture, while adopting a UN convention that condemned its practice, the United States left this contradiction buried like a political landmine ready to explode, to detonate with such phenomenal force just 10 years later in the Abu Ghraib prison scandal. Part 3, perfection. Right after his public address to a shaken nation on September 11, 2001, President Bush turned to his White House staff and gave them secret orders for torture, saying, quote, "I don't care what the international lawyers say, we are going to kick some ass." In the months that followed, administration attorneys translated their presence, eloquent but otherwise unlawful orders into U.S. policy by adopting three controversial neoconservative legal doctrines. Doctrine one, the president is above the law. Doctrine two, torture is legally acceptable. And Doctrine 3, the U.S. Navy base at Guantanamo Bay is not U.S. territory. To focus on the single doctrine most germane to our discussion of psychological torture, then Assistant Attorney Jay Bybee found grounds in his now notorious August 2002 memo for exculpating any CIA interrogators who tortured, but later claimed his intention was information instead of pain. Moreover, by parsing the UN and U.S. definitions of torture as severe physical or mental pain, Bybee concluded that pain equivalent to organ failure was legal, effectively allowing torture up to, but not including, death. Less visibly, the Bush administration began building a global gulag for torture at Abu Ghraib, Bagram, Guantanamo, and a half dozen additional black sites worldwide. In February 2002, the White House assured the CIA that the administration's public pledge to abide by the spirit of the Geneva Conventions did not apply to CIA operatives, and it allowed the agency 10 enhanced interrogation methods designed by agency psychologists. One of them was a technique called waterboarding. This technique, which simulates drowning, was called torturae gallicae ordinariae, or standard French torture, in a 1541 French judicial handbook. And it would now become what CIA Director Porter Goss called in March 2005 a professional interrogation technique. In the 16th century, standard French torture. In the early 21st century, a professional interrogation technique. Now, there are several methods for achieving this effect. For example, by forcing the victim to lie prone and then constricting breathing with a wet cloth, as was done by the French Inquisition and today by the CIA. Or by forcing water directly into the lungs, as was done by French paratroopers during the Algerian War in the 1950s. After French paratroopers used this technique on him during the Battle for Algiers in 1957, the French journalist Henri Allègue wrote a moving description that turned the French people against both torture and the Algerian War. "I tried," Allègue wrote, "by contracting my throat to take in as little water as possible and to resist suffocation by keeping air in my lungs for as long as I could. But I couldn't hold on for more than a few moments. I had the impression of drowning, and a terrible agony, that of death itself, took possession of me." Now, these are sparse words. Let's think about the deeper meaning of Allègue's sparse words, "a terrible agony, that of death itself." What does this mean? As the water blocks air to the lungs, the human organism's powerful mammalian diving reflex kicks in, and the brain is racked by horrifically painful signals. Death, death, death. Then the victim vomits out the water, the lungs suck in air, and the panic subsides. And then it happens again, and again, and again, and again, each time inscribing the searing trauma of near death in human memory. In late 2002, Defense Secretary Rumsfeld appointed General Jeffrey Miller to command Guantanamo Prison with a wide latitude for interrogation, making this prison an ad hoc behavioral laboratory. Moving beyond the original attack on sensory receptors, universal to all human beings, Guantanamo's interrogators stiffened the psychological assault by exploring first Arab cultural sensitivity to sexuality, gender identity, and fear of dogs. Moreover, General Miller also formed behavioral science consultation teams, or biscuit teams, of military psychologists who probed each detainee for individual phobias, such as fear of dark or attachment to mother. Through this total three-phase attack on sensory receptors, cultural identity, and individual psyche, Guantanamo perfected the CIA's psychological paradigm. Significantly, after regular inspections of Guantanamo from 2002 to 2004, the Red Cross, the International Red Cross, reported, quote, "The construction of such a system cannot be considered other than an intentional system of cruel, unusual, and degrading treatment and a form of torture." To illustrate these techniques, let me show now a two-minute segment from a recent documentary film, which I think has been shown in this hall, titled The Road to Guantanamo, about three British Muslim detainees known as the Tipton Three, that recreates their interrogation. John, are we ready?
Yesterday was nice. I was in ISO for ages, for about 2 or 3 months, like.
There's a hook on the floor. The leg irons are attached to the hook. Then they put your hands between your ankles at the floor and chain you to the hook on the floor as well. They keep you there for like an hour, sometimes 2 hours, 5 hours, 6 hours. You can't go to the toilet. You have to urinate to defecate where you are.
Actually, this depiction's too flat. Real interrogation, real interrogators practice the technique. They alternate surfeit and deficit of sensory stimulus, light and dark, sound and silence, hot and cold, and then like some whacked out, perverse DJ, they kind of get it going. They get a little light, they get a little dark, they get a little sound. I mean, they're just doing it. They're going with it, you know, it works. It's kind of, it's inspired, like spinning the pliers. And then the one thing, we can look at that from the outside, but we cannot even begin to imagine what that's like from the inside as you're bombarded with these stimuli. And the mixture of these stimuli, surfeit and deprivation combined with the physical pain, that's the technique. These enhanced interrogation policies, originally used only against top Al-Qaeda operatives, soon proliferated to involve thousands of ordinary Iraqis when Baghdad suffered a wave of terror bombings in mid-2003 that launched the current resistance to U.S. occupation. After a visit from the Guantanamo Chief General Miller in September 2003, the U.S. Commander for Iraq, Lieutenant General Ricardo Sanchez, issued orders for sophisticated psychological torture. Now, as I read these orders, Please listen for the defining components of psychological torture, specifically sensory disorientation, self-inflicted pain, and that recent innovation, attack on Arab cultural sensitivity. Let me read now the order. You, environmental manipulation, altering the environment to create moderate discomfort, e.g., adjusting temperatures or introducing an unpleasant smell. V, sleep adjustment, adjusting the sleeping times of the detainee, e.g., reversing the sleeping cycles from night to day. Isolation, isolating the detainee from other detainees for 30 days. Presence of military working dogs, exploits Arab fear of dogs while maintaining security during interrogations. AA, yelling, loud music and light control, used to create fear, disorient detainee, and prolong capture shock. CC, stress positions, use of physical posturing, sitting, standing, kneeling, prone, etc. Indeed, a review of the hundreds of still classified photos on the Army's CD of those photos from Abu Ghraib reveals not random idiosyncratic acts from separate sadistic minds, but just three psychological torture techniques repeated over and over ad nauseum. Hooding for sensory deprivation, short shackling, long shackling, and enforced standing for self-inflicted pain, total nudity for sexual humiliation, and dogs for that recent innovation, exploitation of Arab cultural sensitivity. It is no accident that Private Lindy England was photographed leading an Iraqi detainee leashed like a dog. Part 4, legalization. Let's look at the aftermath of the Abu Ghraib scandal, seeing how America moved by degrees to impunity for perpetrators and to legalization of CIA psychological torture techniques. Confronted by public anger over detainee abuse at Abu Ghraib, the Bush White House fought back by defending torture as a presidential prerogative. By contrast, an ad hoc civil society coalition of courts, press, and human rights groups mobilized to try and stop the abuse. In a dramatic denouement of June 2006, June last year, the U.S. Supreme Court decided in a landmark decision, Hamdan v. Rumsfeld, that Bush's military commissions at Guantanamo were illegal because they did not meet the requirement under Common Article 3 of the Geneva Conventions that Guantanamo detainees be tried with all the judicial guarantees recognized as indispensable by civilized people. Then on September 6th of last year, in a dramatic bid to legalize his now illegal policies in the aftermath of the Hamdan decision, President Bush announced that he was transferring 14 top al-Qaeda captives from secret CIA prisons to Guantanamo Bay, simultaneously repudiating and legitimating past abuses. Bush denied that he had authorized torture, while simultaneously defending the CIA's use of a tough, quote, alternative sense of procedures to extract, quote, vital information. To allow what he called the CIA program to go forward, President Bush announced that he was sending legislation to Congress that would legalize the same presidential prerogatives in the treatment of detainees that had just been challenged by the Supreme Court. Now, at first, President Bush's draft bill seemed to arouse strong opposition by three Republican veterans on the Senate Armed Services Committee, Senators Graham, McCain, and Warner. But after tense, day-long negotiations inside Vice President Cheney's Senate office on September 21st of last year, these Republican partisans reached a compromise that then sailed through Congress within a week without any amendment to become the Military Commission Law 2006. Now, among its many objectionable features, this law strips detainees of their habeas corpus rights, sanctions endless detention without trial, and allows the use of tortured testimony before the military commissions. Now, most significantly in terms of this talk, by using verbatim the narrow definition of severe mental pain that the United States first adopted back in 1994 when we ratified the UN Convention Against Torture, this new law allows CIA interrogators ample latitude for future psychological torture. This definition of torture is concealed under paragraph 950V, part B, subsection B, on page 70 of this dense 96-page law. This section reads as follows, quote, severe mental pain or suffering defined. In this section, the term severe mental pain has the meaning given that term in section 2340 of Title 18 of the U.S. Federal Code. And what is that definition in section 2340? This is, of course, the same highly restrictive definition of psychological torture that the United States first adopted back in 1994-95 when it ratified the UN Anti-Torture Convention. Simply put, this legislation's highly limiting standard for severe mental suffering does not prohibit any aspect of the sophisticated torture techniques that the CIA has refined over the past half century into a total psychological assault on the human psyche. To make this point clear, let's compare the law's very narrow four-part standard for severe mental suffering under Section 2340 with the CIA's psychological techniques to see which, if any, of the agency's actual torture methods are now banned. Now, under this law, Section 2340, there are only four practices that constitute in any way severe mental pain. And these include, 1, drug injection, 2, death threats, 3, threats against another, 4, extreme physical pain. Now, in actual practice, this definition does not ban any of the dozens of actual CIA methods developed over the past 5 decades, which include self-inflicted pain, sensory disorientation, attacks on cultural identity, attacks on individual psyche, hybrid methods such as waterboarding, and 6th, and most importantly, creative combination of all these methods, which individually might otherwise seem banal, if not benign. Now, if you want an analogy to make the curious exclusionary logic of this legislation perfectly clear, let me turn now to the realm of popular culture. How many people know the board game Clue? Everybody know the board game Clue? Okay, all right. Now, this law would be like, for example, if we'd taken a leaf from the board game Clue and defined murder as only those killings done by Mrs. White in the conservatory with the candlestick, thereby allowing or legalizing all the other murders in the game done by more conventional means such as poison, pistols, rifles, knives, ropes, clubs, or bombs. To test my critical assessment, maybe I'm being too harsh. Maybe this is an important stride forward in the field of human rights. Maybe I'm exaggerating. Let's ask whether this new law bans the most extreme of the CIA's new enhanced methods, waterboarding. Now, while the White House has refused comment, Vice President Cheney stated last October that, quote, a dunk in the water to extract information was, quote, a no-brainer for me. As the administration's leader on interrogation policy, Vice President Cheney's words make clear, despite White House obfuscation, that waterboarding is legal, in its opinion, under the new law. By its omissions, this legislation has effectively legalized the CIA's right to use methods the international community, embodied in the Red Cross and the UN Human Rights Committee, justly considers psychological torture. For the first time in the 200 years since 1791, when the United States Congress ratified the Fifth Amendment to the Constitution banning self-incrimination, Congress has passed a law allowing coerced testimony in U.S. courts. The implications of this military commission's law are profound, and this law is now facing legal challenge. But when this case reaches the Supreme Court, we cannot expect that a Roberts court will overturn this law with the same ringing rhetoric that we have seen in two recent landmark Supreme Court decisions, Rasul v. Bush and Hamdan v. Rumsfeld. If this law stands with its provisions for torture and drumhead justice at Guantanamo, then the United States will suffer, I argue, continuing damage to its moral leadership in the international community. Looking through a glass darkly into the future, Washington may try to return to that convenient Cold War contradiction: public compliance with human rights treaties and secret torture in contravention of those same diplomatic conventions. Yet the world is no longer blind to once clandestine CIA methods, and this attempted secrecy will likely produce another scandal similar to Abu Ghraib. Next time, our protestations of innocence will ring hollow, and the damage to U.S. prestige will be even greater. Conclusion 1, historical methods. Let me conclude now with two conclusions, one historical and the other political. First, the historical. If we were to stand back from our current debate over torture and draw some broader or purely academic conclusions, I would argue that investigators, historical or journalistic, can find the historical method a powerful paradigm a powerful tool for probing the covert netherworld. By beginning in the past, where time clarifies patterns of problems like an emulsion in a photographer's darkroom, the investigator can trace these trends towards the present, seeing significant facts or phenomena that would otherwise remain obscure. To cite an example germane to this talk, almost all of the countless stories about detainee abuse at Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo over the past 2 years have treated this issue in isolation, utterly unaware of the succession of similar events over the past 35 years, all the way from, let's say, the 1970 controversy over the CIA's Phoenix program of torture and assassination led by William Colby, and a controversy sparked by his testimony that the program had killed through extrajudicial execution 20,000 suspected Viet Cong. Next to 1974, when we had a controversy over U.S. torture training in Brazil that led to the abolition of the Office of Public Safety, a U.S. police training program controlled by the CIA. Next, a year later, 1975, we saw the senatorial revelations of CIA drug experiments by the U.S. Senate's Church Committee. In 1978, reporter Cy Hirsch exposed CIA training for the Shah's brutal Savak torturers. In 1998, the New York Times exposed torture in Honduras by local military trained in interrogation by the CIA. In 1997, there was a momentary media sensation over publication of a CIA torture handbook, that Human Resources Exploitation Manual, 1983, right up to 2004, when we see the release of the photographs from Abu Ghraib showing U.S. soldiers abusing Iraqi detainees. Although these stories explored the same topic, the U.S. use of torture for counterinsurgency by the same agency, the CIA, each story in this 35-year succession was reported in isolation, diminishing its significance and its impact. By using this historical method that traces a thread from past to present, investigators can identify threads that tie these otherwise separate stories together, taking care to watch for the subtle signs of continuity and discontinuity, the continuity of patterns and personnel that might carry these trends to the present, and discontinuities that might rupture this same pattern. In every investigation, diverse documentary sources are essential to creating an historical framework for the inquiry. With the in-depth, independent knowledge that documents allow, investigators can reduce the risk of confronting the dangerous covert netherworld with direct questions about present derelictions and instead ask indirect questions about the past. In effect, reporters and historians can apply lessons from history's first recorded training session for academic investigators. In Shakespeare's Hamlet, Act 2, Scene 1, when Polonius tells Reynaldo to investigate his son's dissolute student life in Paris discreetly and by indirections find direction out. If investigators follow this time-tested advice, they can hopefully avoid the sad fate of this play's other untrained investigators, Rosencrantz and Guildenstern. And I think we all know what happened to Rosencrantz and Guildenstern. If we look beyond these mundane matters of documents and sources, we can come ultimately to the essential ingredient in all successful investigations, inspiration. Each exemplary investigation should, I would argue, encourage the rest of us to remain open to the inspired insights and transformative encounters that can direct our inquiries in the rigorous, relentless search for truth to illumine the covert netherworld, which has become such a powerful, and I would argue, problematic force in modern life. Conclusion two, political. Finally, let me offer what I see as some possible political lessons from this history. Now, if history repeats itself not as tragedy but as farce, then this repetition of CIA Cold War torture for the war on terror has been so utterly unnecessary that it is almost a bad joke on this country. It's a farce. Now, while President Bush has shaped the debate as a false choice between tortured intelligence and no intelligence at all, there are, in fact, well-established American alternatives to torture. Just as the CIA's psychological torture has been a distinctively American form of torture, so there is an alternative American approach that we might call empathetic interrogation, which is quick, reliable, and completely legal. During World War II, the legendary Marine Corps interrogator, Major Sherwood Moran, a former missionary fluent in Japanese, used empathy to establish intellectual and spiritual rapport with Japanese captives, prompting the U.S. Marines to train a corps of interrogators who elicited complete order of battle intelligence from supposedly fanatical Japanese soldiers on Saipan and Tinian within 24 hours of the U.S. landing on those islands. This same technique of empathetic interrogation has been practiced and perfected by the FBI in the decades since the end of World War II. Indeed, from 1942 until 2002, a period of 60 years, the FBI controlled counterintelligence operations using this method quite successfully to investigate threats to our domestic security. For example, after the bombings of the U.S. embassies in East Africa in 1998, FBI teams interrogated captured terrorists, gained some of our best intelligence on al-Qaeda, and won convictions of all the accused in U.S. federal courts. With the release of those Abu Ghraib photos and revelations about Guantanamo, Americans are now faced with a choice that will influence the character of their nation and its reputation in the eyes of the world. We can honor our commitments under law and treaty to ban torture unconditionally, or we can agree with the Bush administration's decision to make torture a permanent weapon in the awesome arsenal of American power. As a powerfully symbolic state practice, synonymous with tyrants, torture, even of the few, even of just one, raises profound moral issues about the quality of America's justice and the legitimacy of its global leadership. Alberto Mora, the U.S. Navy's general counsel, who fought inside the Bush administration to stop the Pentagon's use of psychological torture at Guantanamo, has warned us, quote, "Cruelty disfigures our national character. Where cruelty exists, law does not. A law that legalizes such cruelty, the Military Commissions Act 2006, will remain a stain on America's standing as a nation of laws until it is either overturned by the U.S. Supreme Court or rescinded by the U.S. Congress." Thank you.
Where is the level of outrage in the American public outside of the activist community? And it, like months and months after Abu Ghraib, it just seems to be like as if people either don't know or don't care or are more obsessed with American Idol or sports. Why is there like no constant outrage about this?
First of all, the question is, why is there no outrage over the issue of torture? I think we'd have to break that into two parts, just as the questioner did. First of all, the general public. Why the low level of outrage among the general public? One can only hypothesize about why the Iraq War is not a more burning issue. To make the analogy with Vietnam, the Vietnam era was many things, but certainly the level of outrage and public concern was extraordinarily high. Now it isn't, and the general observation by many people, for example, Representative Charles Rangel of New York, now head of the House Judiciary Committee, is that the draft. You guys are not up for the draft, and therefore you are not mobilized. My generation was, we were mobilized. So simple self-interest turned us into momentary idealists. We've now cashed out and, you know, working in that 401k and, you know, that retirement. But I mean, back then, you know, we were concerned. We were outraged because our self-interest and the misbegotten policy of our nation came together, and that made us all, regardless of who we might have been, into momentary idealists. Well, now that's not so. That's just a hypothesis. More specifically, the level of outrage among more activist or involved elements of the society, always a minority. Actually, I think I would disagree with the questioner. I think the level of anger over the torture policy is enormous, okay? If you think about the American political spectrum, there are issues generally involving sexuality or procreation that mobilize the extreme right of the Republican Party. Let's say partial birth abortion was a kind of iconic issue that got them out and that put the Republicans in Congress and kept them there for that 12-year period. I think last year what we saw was a widespread debate among those of a more activist inclination on the sort of left side of the Democratic Party that just as partial birth abortion was an iconic issue that mobilized the right, so torture served as an iconic issue that mobilized the left. The net result was the Democrats are back in Congress, okay? Now, they're back in Congress, but of course they're going to naturally gravitate to the middle. And just as those right-wing Republicans mobilized to try and scourge the Republican Party once in power to do their bidding, so it behooves us on the American liberal or the American left to begin to pressure the Democratic Party that now they're in office, we'd like to see some action on our agenda. And so, in fact, I would attribute in part the Democratic success in the midterm elections as a part of this intellectual ferment and mobilization, okay? So I'm not quite so despairing. All that anger, all that energy got challenged in the political process. Now we've got the Democrats back in Congress. Now, about the time we're exhausted, we all want to go home and, you know, not work. Now is the time that we need to begin working. Yes?
My question is that I've talked to a lot of people about torture, and they're disgusted by it or horrified. They feel helpless to stop it. They feel like, well, there's nothing I as an individual could possibly do that could influence. And so my question to you is, since you're talking to a group of students, what would be two or three things that you would suggest doing in order to try to stop torture?
There are a host of things that can be done. First of all, on most campuses, there's a chapter of Amnesty International. Amnesty is now running a very vigorous campaign to stop torture. They're very active. Amnesty, you might say, okay, what's the relationship between what I do on this campus and Amnesty International? Amnesty International has a $40 million a year budget. Where does that come from? From all those buttons and leaflets and things that you sell on campuses. Amnesty International is just a giant bake sale, okay? All that money is collected, and that creates an office in Washington, D.C., where Amnesty has some very good lobbyists, usually young people like yourselves, just out of college, who are very well informed, and I met them, and they work extraordinarily hard. And they're beating down the corridors of Congress, knocking on doors. Okay, so that's what you do here. You join an Amnesty chapter, you sell those buttons, you show a film, whatever it is that people do to raise money, that money percolates through. And Amnesty is a grassroots organization. They meet, and their agenda is set by the members, okay? They've won a Nobel Prize. That's the institutionalization of this global opposition to torture. That's, I would say, the first and most important thing you can do. Second, being informed on the issue. We are now engaged, in fact, in a wide-ranging public debate on two related issues, okay? One is, more broadly, the efficacy, the utility of torture. Does torture work? Do we really need to, if torture works, don't we really need to use it? There's a complex culture, a question that's being debated in public culture. Where is it being debated? Fox Network, 24. Before that, NYPD Blue. Both of those shows dramatize and make a case for the utility, the effectiveness of torture. Okay? So there's a public debate out there that's in the airwaves, and by reading and informing yourself, you can participate in that debate. And there are some, as a part of that, kind of the third thing you can do, is there are some excellent reports that have come out over the last few years that a whole series of organizations like Amnesty that are involved in this issue. Amnesty itself has some very good reports, quite succinct. Human Rights Watch, Human Rights First, and Physicians for Human Rights, among other organizations, do very good reporting. So by going online, just keying in their names for, you know, in a nanosecond, you've got these reports on your desk. And as you move through this society, like all of us do, and you debate and discuss and interact, and you express your opinion, you're spreading a different point of view. You are engaging in a kind of battle for ideas, which is, after all, our government policy is nothing more still, even today, as the sum of the views of the people in this society. So by being active, engaged, and informed citizens, you're doing the most important thing that anybody can do.